Now we're in the section now where the family is coming up to Egypt with Pharaoh's blessing. And D says, Exodus 1:5 returns to the same theme by reminding the reader of seven descendants of Jacob who went into Egypt and of their great increase during their sojourn there. And the same theme is the fact, remember we said there were 70 nations coming from Adam? The Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous so that the land was filled with them. They were very, very like rabbits. Into the land of Goshen, verses 28 to 34. So let's read verses 28 to 34. Now he sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out the way before him to Goshen, and they came into the land of Goshen. He is Jacob. Joseph prepared his chariot and went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel. As soon as he appeared before him, he fell on his neck and wept on his neck a long time. They're big crybabies, you know. Now, I'd probably cry too if I hadn't seen my father in years. Then Israel says to Joseph, "Now let me die, since I have seen your face, that you are still alive." Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, "I will go up and tell Pharaoh and will say to him, 'My brothers and my fathers who were in the land of Canaan have come to me.' And the men are shepherds, for they have been keepers of livestock, and they have bought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. When Pharaoh calls you and says, 'What is your occupation?' you shall say, 'Your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth even until now, both we and our fathers, so that you may live in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is loathsome to the Egyptians.'" The Egyptians didn't like shepherds.
Is it Yosef's shepherd?
Excuse me?
The Hyksos had come in and defeated the Egyptians, and they were the shepherd. And I'm very sorry, what chapter are we in? 46, verse 28. Now we're just finished.
We just finished 30. We're up to, in the notes, we're going to start reading where it says, "Into the land of Goshen." Curiously, in the narrative itself, it was Judah, not Joseph, who led the sons of Israel into the land of Goshen. Once again, it appears as though Moses has singled out Judah for special attention over against Joseph. And we'll see why when we get a little further in the notes. Although in the Joseph story as a whole, it was Joseph who was responsible for the preservation of the sons of Egypt. That shouldn't be Egypt, it should be Israel. Bad typo. Here, within the details of the passage, it was Judah who pointed the way to get directions to the land of Goshen. So you see what's happening here. Judah's beginning to be exalted a little bit, and Joseph is just a little bit fading into the background, and we'll see why. Such a special focus on Judah is part of an overall strategy of Moses to highlight the crucial role of Judah in God's plan to bring about Israel's deliverance. The prominence of Judah is seen most clearly in Jacob's words of blessing to his 12 sons. And what we're going to see when we get to 49 is Judah, what line comes from Judah? The line of David. That's why it's so significant. The royal line comes from Judah. The chapter ends with Joseph's plan to secure the land of Goshen as a dwelling place for the sons of Israel. The plan was simply to tell Pharaoh that they were shepherds. As Moses informs us, the Egyptians hated shepherds and would thus allow the Israelites to dwell off by themselves in the land of Goshen. The land of Goshen is what you might call a suburb, in a sense. In the next chapter, Joseph's plan succeeded, and the people were given the land of Goshen. The land of Goshen was a very fertile land. In these two brief narratives, Joseph and Judah are placed in marked contrast. Judah led the brothers to the land of Goshen, but it was Joseph's plan that resulted in their being able to live there. So already we're beginning to see a contrast between Joseph and Judah, and that contrast is going to become more significant. What's this? Whoops. I gotta put this here. Excuse me. Okay. Okay, so now we go. Oh. 20. Did I have 29 in here? No, I got a little more reading to do from this chapter. I'm sorry. We have to read verses 29 to 34. Did we read it from the scriptures? No. Wait. What is that? We read the 28. No, we didn't read 29 to 34. You sure? No, we didn't read it. I'm looking at it. We didn't read it. We just read through 27. We got to read 28, actually. Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years, so the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. When the time came for Israel to die drew near, he called his son Joseph to him and said, "Please, if I have found favor in your sight, place now your hand under my thigh." You know what that was the equivalent of? What am I doing? What, in 46? Okay, I'm sorry. You're right. Well, when you're right, you know. You've got to admit that. Okay, we start chapter 47 now. I was testing you to see if you were right. I knew all along. Yes.
I think the interchange between shepherd and keepers of livestock is interesting because first, up in 46, Joseph tells his brothers, don't say you're shepherds, say you're keepers of livestock. So that'd be cows and, I don't know, goats or not.
Elephants.
And then you get down with Joseph talking to Pharaoh and the brothers telling Pharaoh.
That's because of the nature of the relationship with Pharaoh.
Okay, but yeah. After Joseph and his brothers say that they're shepherds, in 47, when you get to verse 6, Pharaoh says, you know, great, you can have any good land. If you know men of ability are among them, make them chiefs of livestock.
Yeah, because Pharaoh had livestock.
Yeah,
well, I'd imagine a keeper or shepherd wouldn't be too much of a switch to go to a keeper of livestock.
They do
to an extent. You're right. Okay, chapter 47, and we're going to read verses 1 through 12. Then Joseph went in and told Pharaoh and said, "My father and my brothers and their flocks and their herds and all that they have come out of the land of Canaan. Behold, they are here in the land of Goshen." He took five men from among his brothers and presented them to Pharaoh. Then Pharaoh said to his brothers, "What is your occupation?" So they said to Pharaoh, "Your servants are shepherds, both we and our father." See, it didn't bother Pharaoh because of his relationship with Joseph. They said to Pharaoh, "We have come to sojourn in the land, for there is no pasture for your servants' flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now, therefore, please let your servants live in the land of Goshen." Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Your father and your brothers have come to you." See, it's Joseph he really loves. "The land of Egypt is at your disposal. Settle your father and your brothers in the best of the land. Let them live in the land of Goshen. And if you know any capable men among them, put them in charge of my livestock." And basically what he's saying there is, if any of your shepherds can also handle livestock, put them in charge of my livestock. Then Joseph brought his father Jacob and presented him to Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Jacob, "How many years have you lived?" So Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The years of my sojourning are 130, at that point, are 130. Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life, nor have they attained the years that my father lived during the days of their sojourning." And Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from his presence. So Joseph settled his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramesses, as Pharaoh had ordered. So both Pharaoh agreed with Joseph to giving Goshen that land to dwell in. Okay. So, where are we? Joseph provided his father and his brothers and all his father's household with food according to their little ones. Okay, now we go to the notes. Joseph's family settled in Goshen. Throughout the Joseph narratives, Moses has been careful to allow the key events to be told twice. We've noticed that a number of times. The events of chapter 46 and 47 are no exception. Joseph has told his plan to his brothers in chapter 46, and now in chapter 47, Moses describes the outcome of the results of the plan, and that's how Moses usually does it. Description, watch it happen, or sometimes telling of what happened and another telling of what happened. The point is to show that Joseph's plan was successful and thereby reinforce a central theme of the narrative. The Lord was with Joseph and he prospered. Now, there's another way we could say that that applies today. Joseph was with the Lord and he prospered. It goes both ways. So, we need to remember that ourselves. We, of course, want the Lord to be with us. But the way to have the Lord be with you is for you to be with the Lord. Okay, continuing on. Where was I? Oh, here. Joseph's wisdom resulted in the sons of Israel dwelling safely in the land of Goshen. The word where should be the word while. W-H-I-L-E. While there was a severe famine in the land of Canaan. Pharaoh's response was even more generous than the previous narrative would have suggested. Not only did he grant their wish and allow Joseph's brothers to settle in Goshen, he also put the brothers in charge of his own livestock as well, a result curiously reminiscent of Joseph's own rise to power in the house of Pharaoh. He was exalting the entire family. Thus, the narrative shows that Joseph's fortune was duplicated in the fortune of his brothers. And that's reminiscent of Psalm 1. How blessed are those who do not walk in the way of the wicked. The land of Goshen is called the best part of the land, and the Hebrew there is metab, which perhaps is a wordplay on the good, tab, that God intended in all of these recorded events. Significantly, the concern of the narrative is to show that Joseph blessed Pharaoh when he was brought before him. Its importance can be seen from the fact that it was mentioned twice. Lying behind such emphasis in the narrative is God's promise to Abraham that he would bless those who bless the offspring of Abraham. So that first Pharaoh was being blessed, wasn't he? He was being protected. He was blessed through Joseph and ultimately through God, because he blessed the Jewish people, unlike the bad Pharaoh who put them in slavery and was cursed. The passage shows that in Joseph and Jacob, the promise to Abraham was being fulfilled with the nations surrounding them. Okay. The words of Jacob to Pharaoh in verse 9, "My years have been few and difficult, and they do not equal the pilgrimage of my fathers," sounds unusual in the way they contrast with the two accounts of his blessing to Pharaoh. What do Jacob's words mean? They appear to be a deliberate contrast to the later promise in Deuteronomy that one who honors his father and mother should live long and it should go well with him in the land. That's in the Ten Commandments, the first commandment of the promise, because he did not honor his father and mother. He deceived his father. Remember that? Jacob, who deceived his father and thereby gained the blessing, must not only die outside the promised land, but we also learned that his years were few and difficult, relatively few. Okay.
How long did Isaac live?
I can't hear you.
Isaac, how long did he live?
I don't know yet. If I had that good of memory, I wouldn't be here. I'd be like at NASA or something. I know a guy with that kind of memory. From his own words, then, he lived longer than, I do know that he lived longer than 147 years, but less than 200. From his own words, then, we can see a final recompense for Joseph's actions earlier in the book. Be sure your sins will find you out. As Abraham obeyed God and lived long in the land, so Jacob's years were short and difficult. And he did live a difficult life. In spite of such a final verdict on the life of Jacob, the narrative goes on to show that he lived out his remaining years in the best part of the land, though not the promised land, and Joseph, his son, provided for him and his household. Yes. Yeah, I knew it was less than 200, but more than 147. Wonder if I'll live 180 years. Yeah, right. Probably live another day. Okay. Joseph's rule in Egypt, 13 to 27. Now, there was no food in the land because the famine was very severe. Is that right? That where we are? Right. So that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. Joseph gathered all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the grain which they bought, and Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. So you see, Joseph was a pretty astute businessman. See what he's doing here. Now he's selling grain to the Egyptians and getting all their money. And eventually he's going to get all their land too, and then they're going to become servants. He's really feeding on this. When the money was all spent in the land of Egypt, And in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, give us food, for why should we die in your presence? For our money is gone. Then Joseph said, give up your livestock, and I will give you some food for your livestock, since your money is gone. So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them food in exchange for the horses and the flocks and the herds and the donkeys. Notice, no sheep. And he fed them with food in exchange for all their livestock that year. When that year was ended, they came to him next year and said to him, we will not hide from my Lord that our money is all spent and the cattle are my Lord's. There is nothing left for my Lord except our bodies and our lands. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for food, and we and our land will be slaves to Pharaoh. So give us seed that we may live and not die, and that the land may not be desolate. See, Joseph was a pretty clever fellow. So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for every Egyptian sold his field, because the famine was severe upon them. Thus the land became Pharaoh's. As for the people, he removed them to the cities from one end of Egypt's border to the other. Only the land of the priests he did not buy, for the priests had an allotment from Pharaoh. And they lived off the allotment which Pharaoh gave them, similar to what the Jewish people did. Therefore, they did not sell their land. Then Joseph said to the people, behold, I have today bought you and your land for Pharaoh. Now here is seed for you, and you may sow the land. At the harvest you shall give a fifth to Pharaoh, and four-fifths shall be your own. So he's going to tax it. For seed of the field, and for your food, and for your household, as food for your little ones. So they said, you have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's slaves. Joseph made a statute concerning the land of Egypt, faileth to this day. Now, of course, this day is not today. It's when this was written. That Pharaoh should have the fifth, 20%, only the land of the priests did not become Pharaoh's. Now, Israel lived in the land of Egypt and Goshen, and they acquired property in it, and were fruitful and became very numerous. Apparently, they didn't have to be taxed because they lived in a plush land. So they didn't get taxed. Only the Egyptians did. Okay, in the notes, Joseph's rule in Egypt. Moses goes into great detail to show the final steps by which Joseph extended his authority and the authority of Pharaoh over every region of Egypt. The narrative returns to the storyline of 41:57 with an account of the affairs of Joseph in Egypt and his work on behalf of Pharaoh. Remember, it kind of, as an aside, went to Joseph and his brothers. And you'll see that sometimes the narrative is talking about Joseph and his brothers, and sometimes it's just talking about the sons of Jacob, which includes Joseph. Moses, at least temporarily, leaves them behind. The brothers are no longer the center of attention. Moses, at least temporarily, leaves them behind to focus on Joseph and his sons. The narrative returns to the theme of the brothers in chapter 49, but there it is not Joseph and his brothers, rather it is Jacob and his sons, with Joseph simply being one of the brothers. It is only in the end, at verse 15, that returned to the theme of Joseph and his brothers. We might ask what Moses' strategy is in inserting, which I put twice, of course. I have a habit of doing it. I wonder why. The account of Joseph and his brothers in the midst of the narrative dealing with Joseph's rise to power in Egypt. The answer may lie in the way in which the final narrative resembles the story of Joseph and his brothers. Similar themes are seen here. Throughout those narratives, the theme was repeatedly expressed that Joseph's wisdom and administrative skills saved the lives of his brothers and father. Thus, at the beginning of the story, Jacob had told his sons to go down to Egypt to buy grain, that we may live and not die. Then Judah, in the second year, told his father to let them return to Egypt, that we may live and not die. Finally, when he revealed himself to them, Joseph told his brothers that God had sent him to Egypt to save lives. So you see, Judah is becoming increasingly prominent. Let's see how we're doing here. In keeping with that emphasis, the present narrative opens with the statement of the Egyptians to Joseph as they seek to buy grain from him. Why should we die before your eyes? Then it continues with the account of their return to Joseph the following year, when they again said, why should we perish? And then again, that we may live and not die. Such repetitions in the surface structure suggest that a thematic strategy is at work. First with the brothers, and then with the Egyptians, Joseph's wisdom is seen as the source of life for everyone in the land. He not only saved his brothers and his family, but he saved all of Egypt. A further evidence of a distinct strategy behind the present narrative in 47 can be seen in the ironic twist given the earlier narratives by the outcome of this chapter. The whole of the story of Joseph and his brothers began with Joseph being sold into slavery for 20 pieces of silver. Now here's the irony. Now at the conclusion, Joseph is shown selling the whole of the land of Egypt into slavery and taking his family's money, silver. So it's all returned back to him and more. In the end, because of the wisdom of Joseph, the offspring of Abraham became fruitful, increased greatly in number, and were dwelling safely and prosperously in the land of Goshen. Such a picture seems to be an obvious replication of the intended blessing of the earlier chapters of Genesis. Be fruitful, increase in numbers, fill the earth. So in a certain sense, Jacob can be seen as a second Adam. But he's not the second Adam theologically. Messiah is the second Adam. But you can see similarities here. Okay. Jacob's burial instructions, 28 to 31. Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years, so the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. When the time for Israel drew near, he called his son Joseph and said to him, please, if I have found favor in your sight, place now your hand under my thigh and deal with me in kindness and faithfulness. Placing your hand under someone's thigh back then was like, let's shake on it. It's very similar. Please do not bury me in Egypt. But when I lie with my fathers, you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place. And he said, I will do as you have said. That's Joseph. He said, swear to me. So he swore to him. Then Egypt bowed in worship at the head of the bed. Joseph's burial instructions in the notes. The thread of narrative continues from verses 8 to 12, where at his last mention, Jacob's age had been given as 130 years. To return to the subject of Jacob, Moses bridges the narrative gap with the summation of all the years of his life, 17 years in Egypt and 130 give a total of 147. The initial impression from this verse is that the Jacob narratives are coming to a close, but such is not the case. Two crucial chapters remain. The function of verse 28 is twofold. Let's look at verse 28 again. Where is verse 28? There it is. But when I lie down with my fathers, you shall carry me out of the land of Egypt and bury me in their burial place. And he said, I will do as you have said. Where was I? The function of verse 28 is twofold. It first provides continuity with the Jacob narrative that had been broken into by the account of Joseph's further rise to power. And second, it moves the narratives to a new time frame 17 years later. Perhaps the underlying assumption intended is that by now the famine was over and Joseph's position in Egypt had been well established. With such matters behind, Moses moves on to the last days of Jacob. Excuse me? Okay. As he approached death, 29, yeah, I read all the way through 31.
Well, no, but your reference was in B, 8B.
Oh, okay. All right, I'm sorry. Oh, okay. Try and be careful about that. Yeah. As he approached death, Jacob's only request was that he not be buried in the land of Egypt. The manner of the request suggested that it is intended as an allusion back to the sending of Abraham's servant for a bride for Isaac. Remember Eliezer? Put your hand under my thigh and promise. That's exactly what Abraham did with Eliezer. The similarity between the two requests are obvious. As he approached death, Abraham did not want his son to take a wife from among the people of the land where he was then dwelling, but rather to take a wife from among his own people. In the same way, as he approached death, Jacob did not want to be buried among the Egyptians, but with his fathers in his own land. Okay? The same theme is taken up in chapter 50, when Joseph makes his sons swear that they will carry his bones to the promised land, a request carried out by the sons of Israel and Joshua. What did you say today's date was? The 21st? Okay, let's take our first break. Okay, chapter 48 has an introduction. The phrase after these things suggests an important break in the narrative and separates this passage from the events that have been preceded. If in 48:1, you'll see where it says, now it came about after these things. Chapter 48 forms a fitting conclusion to the Jacob narratives. As in the earlier patriarchal narratives, the blessing of the father is passed on to the next generation. Two features in this passage stand out. First, as with the earlier instances of the patriarchal blessings, it was not the younger son, Ephraim, who was blessed as the firstborn, rather the older, Manasseh. It was, you're right, I saw that as soon as I read it. It was the younger son who was blessed as the firstborn rather than the older, Manasseh. Notice firstborn is one word. In this respect, the passage continues the theme that the blessing did not follow the theme, that the blessing did not follow the natural line of descent or natural right. Okay. Second, the blessing was a gift bestowed on those who could not claim it as a right, according to tradition. The blessing was a bestowed gift recorded in this chapter subordinated and superseded by the blessing of Jacob that follows in chapter 49. And the key here really is God lifts those up whom he chooses to lift up and brings down those whom he wants to bring down. This is not a work of man, it's a work of God. God gave man authority over the earth, but when God chooses so, he can be sovereign. He is sovereign and can step in. It has been an interesting feature of the entire Joseph narratives that Judah, rather than Joseph, who ultimately prevailed in gaining the position of preeminence among his brothers. As important as Joseph is to the structure of the Genesis narratives, his role is subordinate to that of Judah, and there's a good reason for that. Consequently, the blessing of the sons of Joseph recorded in this passage do not play a significant role in the Genesis story. Rather, it is the blessing of Judah in chapter 49 that plays the dominant role in the continuing story of the promise and the blessing. From Judah comes the house of David, and from David comes the Messiah. That is the focus of the biblical story that follows. So you can see how Judah is actually preeminent in regarding to the return of the blessing, the line of the blessing. The two sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, play an important role in the text dealing with the divided northern kingdom. But Moses' attention to that kingdom, which ultimately was dispersed and lost in the dispersion, pales quickly in the rising star of David. Okay, now we'll read verses 1 through 6. Then Jacob summoned his sons and said, "Assemble yourselves that I may tell you what will befall you in the days..." No. Wrong chapter. Okay, we have to read 1 through 6. Now it came about after these things that Joseph was told, "Behold, your father is sick." So he took his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, with him. When it was told to Jacob, "Behold, your son Joseph has come to you," Israel collected his strength and sat up in the bed. Then Jacob said to Joseph, "God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me. And he said to me, 'Behold, I will make you fruitful and numerous, and I will make you a company of peoples, and I will give this land to your descendants after you for an everlasting possession.' Now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine, as Reuben and Simeon are. But your offspring that have been born after them shall be yours. They shall be called by the names of their brothers in their inheritance." Okay. Now we go down to the last days of Jacob. Once again, we are reminded of the frailty of Jacob, and we can see that his life is drawing to a close. However, after he saw Joseph and his two sons, Jacob was revived and he prepared to bestow God's blessings on the house of Joseph. Jacob's recollection of God's promise to him at Bethel is significant. He repeated the Lord's words almost verbatim, but in the minor alterations we can see not only Jacob's recollection of the promise, but also Moses' perspective. As he had acknowledged in verse 39, so now Jacob recalled that God had blessed him. When he recounted what God had said, Jacob brought a meaning to God's words that helps clarify the reader's understanding of the Lord's promised blessing. This blessing is passed on from generation to generation. In 35:11, the Lord had said, using the imperative mood, be fruitful and multiply and increase in number. The use of the imperative blessing is not unusual and should be understood not as a command, but as a form of well-wishing. It's like if I say to you, go with God, that's an imperative, right? But it's really a well-wishing. And that's what this means here. The Lord was saying, may you be fruitful and increase. Not like, be fruitful and increase. He wasn't giving them a command. He was giving them a well-wishing, a blessing. Just as in Genesis 1:28. But as Jacob retold the story to Joseph in this chapter, he did not use the imperative, but changed the verbal form to stress that God was the one who would bring about all that he had promised. I am going to make you fruitful and will increase your numbers. I will make you a community of peoples, and I will give you this land as an everlasting possession to your descendants after you. Notice that word everlasting. Not until 1948 or 19, everlasting. As he looked back on the blessing and recounted it to his sons, Jacob brought out just that aspect of the blessing that had been the theme of the Joseph narratives. God would ultimately bring about all that he had promised. All that had happened to the house of Jacob was in God's plan and was intended by him for good. And we'll see that really completely clarified in when we get to chapter 50:20. A second nuance is noticeable in Jacob's recounting of the promise. When he recounted God's promise of the land, he did so verbatim. I will give you this land to your descendants after you. He added, as an everlasting possession, a statement that was not recorded in chapter 35. So once, it didn't say it was going to happen right then, but once the Jewish people finally obtain the land, it's going to be permanent forever. That means even into the eternal state. Only one other time is the promise of the land called an everlasting possession. There, too, when the promise was given to Abraham, the form of the blessing was not an imperative. It was be fruitful and increase, which was a well-wishing. But the form of the verb denoting God as the subject of the action, be fruitful and increase, the Lord says, it should say, but in the form. And I have another, I don't know why I repeat things. God is the subject of the action. Be fruitful, increase. The Lord says, I will greatly increase your numbers and I will make you be very fruitful. So obviously it's going to happen and he's wishing them well. God's not going to command you to do something that he's going to do. He's wishing him well. It may also be significant that Jacob omitted one of the key elements of the promise that the Lord had made them in chapter 35. The Lord had said, kings will come from your body, but in the present chapter, no mention of that part of the promise is made. Probably the stress on Judah with regard to the kingship in chapter 49 has preceded any mention of the promise of kings in reference to Joseph. Okay, verse 7, the sons of Joseph. Now as for me, when I came from Padan, Rachel died to my sorrow in the land of Canaan on the journey, when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath. And I buried her there on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. The sons of Joseph. The two sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, here were taken into the family of Jacob and were treated as his own. So they became part of the family of Jacob. They, along with the other sons of Jacob, would inherit the promise of Abraham. So if you're a descendant of Ephraim and Manasseh, you're an inheritor of the promise. You're Jewish. It's a simple way of putting it. Henceforth, the families of Ephraim and Manasseh were encouraged, were counted among the sons of Jacob, and were to be treated as his own, and later became two of the most important tribes in Israel. In later biblical texts, these two names became synonymous with the northern kingdom of Israel. In fact, God often calls the northern kingdom of Israel Ephraim. Verse 7 has long puzzled interpreters. Why the mention of Rachel at this point in the narrative? If we relate the verse to what precedes, then the mention of Rachel here could be prompted by the fact that she had borne Jacob two sons, Joseph and Benjamin, at a time when he was about to enter the land. So also Jacob gave Jacob two sons. Wait, there were sons there. Sons, just at the time when he was about to enter Egypt. Such symmetry suggests that Ephraim and Manasseh are replacements for Joseph and Benjamin, which serves to further the sense of divine providence behind the events of Jacob's life. Furthermore, Jacob's recollection is virtually verbatim to that of the account of Rachel's death in 35. In both passages, the stress is laid. In both passages, the stress is laid on the site of Ephrath, which Moses identifies in both passages as Jerusalem. As an earlier case in the concern, the burial of the patriarchs in the promised land, As in earlier cases, in the concern, of the burial of the patriarchs in the promised land, Jacob's mention of the burial is tied to the promise that the land would be an eternal possession of the seed of Abraham. Rachel's burial place, like Abraham's and Sarah's and Jacob's own impending burial site, serves as a reminder of the faithfulness of God to his covenant promises. They believe that would become the land of their descendants. Okay, verses 8 to 22. Let me see how I'm doing here. I don't think we're going to have time for 8 to 22. It's a little bit too much. It's way too much. Yeah, we're not going to have time for 8 to 20. This will be a good stopping point. We'll begin next time with Roman numeral 6. What's next week's date? 13th? Wait, 21st, 28th? Today's the 21st. 28th. Okay, wait, let me turn this off.